Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we invite you to call in and ask questions about prescription medication. That is a subject that from time to time we like to try to touch on. There are many medicines out on the market now. There are some people who take multiple medications. There's always the possibility of problems with misuse or with interaction between drugs. So we like to try on at least a fairly regular basis to give folks the chance to call in and ask questions. And that is what we're doing here this morning. And our guest for the program is Dr. Harold Silverman. He has been a hospital pharmacist, an industry consultant, an author, and educator for more than 35 years. He is the editor-in-chief of The Pill Book. It is an illustrated guide to the most prescribed drugs in the United States. It's now out in its new and revised 13th edition. It's a big paperback book. It is published by Bantam, and the idea is that it's a reference that has information on a wide range of prescription drugs that you or someone in your family may be taking. And it has information on what they are and what they are prescribed for, what warnings there are involved with possible side effects, interactions with other drugs, various kinds of information. It's a good kind of resource to have on your shelf if you're interested in finding more about medications that you're taking. So it's something that you can go out and buy. There are quite a few of these in print already. And we're here to answer your questions, and I'm sure that Dr. Silverman will do his best to give an answer. He's taught pharmacology and clinical pharmacy at several universities, has won a number of awards for his work, and he's been good enough to spend some time with us this morning on the phone. So as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Dr. Silverman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, no problem. I'd love to do it.
Something, you know, that I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about here at the beginning. It seems that we are starting to see or have seen recently increasing numbers of accidental poisonings or drug overdoses involving prescription medication that may be from careless use, or that may be that people are taking multiple medications and they're not aware of or not thinking about the effects of all the way that all these things add up together in the body at the same time. And
right.
And I think that particularly people perhaps might think that, well, if it's a prescription medicine, well, that means it's safe and I don't have to worry about the effects of taking it or taking things in combination. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, you're right. I mean, we're really concerned about the problems that are associated not only with poisonings and overdoses, but with people taking the wrong medications or being dispensed the wrong medications, both in hospitals and in community pharmacies. And these are mistakes that derive from many different problems that people are working hard to solve right now. But the issue that you raise, which is quite, I find actually quite interesting, I've never heard it expressed in that way before, is that people think that prescription drugs are safe because they've been prescribed by their doctor. But actually, the drug products that are the safest for people that have been deemed the safest, at least, by the FDA, the federal regulatory agency that controls these products, are the over-the-counter drugs, the products that you can buy in a pharmacy or a supermarket, convenience store, you know, without a prescription. Mm-hmm. So those are the safest because the judgment has been made that they can be used by an individual without the involvement of a professional, you know, making a decision on your behalf. And the other thing that people need to understand is that anytime you do anything related to medical care, whether it's taking a prescription drug or having a procedure done, there are risks involved. And so there's always one of the things that doctors always have to do and pharmacists are very involved in managing is this risk to benefit relationship.
Mm.
You know,
well,
what's the
No, pardon me for interrupting there. I guess I was just thinking about, well, first of all, I wouldn't want people to somehow think that I was suggesting that prescription drugs were not safe.
Right.
And although I guess I'm thinking that it would be important advice, and I expect that you would agree that people should, one, they should do their best to take them as directed.
Yes.
That if they do think they're having some sort of drug-related side effect, they should either they should call their doctor or talk to the pharmacist mm-hmm. and at least say, look, this is what's going on. Do you think this is a problem? And then perhaps the third thing is if you're taking multiple medications, it is recommended that if you can, you get them all at the same place so that someone knows everything that you're taking and they can spot the possibility of interactions.
Right. And those are all excellent points. The problem of multiple medications especially gets more serious or more common, let's say, as we advance in age, because those of us who are a few years older tend to take more medications, and actually that's a good thing, because we have some new products today and newly developed drugs that were simply not available years back and have helped people make tremendous strides in managing their condition. In diabetes, for example, the practice of managing diabetes has changed drastically from years ago, where it was really when people came in with severe disease and, you know, had to have limbs amputated and were going blind and, you know, all that, to the point today where there's enough different medication available and a variety of medication that the practice is now managing this chronic illness. So it's very important for people to take their medicine exactly as prescribed, especially with anti-infectives and antibiotics, where people sometimes feel well or feel better after they've been taking their product, their medicine for only, you know, 2 or 3 days, so they think they don't have to take it any longer, but they really do have to finish taking it all. And the other problem that we, and other problem that we find is that people tend to share their medicines. And of course that's not a good thing, because that means that you're basically giving someone else a drug product that they may or may not, that may or may not be right for them. But also, it indicates that that means that you have something left over in your medicine cabinet that has not been used. And the question is, why not?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting set of circumstances. And yes, definitely, if you have any questions or feel anything different, you should examine that and ask the doctor, ask the pharmacist, check a reference book like the pill book, which is written in plain language so that people can understand. That's really our objective here. So it's an area where people can do a lot to protect themselves and to manage their own health care.
One other question, then I'm going to go on here to some of the callers that we have, just to pick up on an earlier point that you made about the possibility that someone would go in someplace with their prescription and hand it over, and that there would be a mistake made and that they'd get the wrong medicine. One of the values of a book like the pill book is that it has a section in here where it shows in color what all the pills look like. Is that something you actually recommend, that people should, but before they take it, they should just try to make sure that that they are, in fact, what it is they've got, the pill that they've got, is the one that they were prescribed?
Well, that would be great. I mean, unfortunately, we don't have enough room in the book itself to have pictures of everything. We try to cover the most popular medications and their group by color, and we try to show the the logos on the tablets and capsules. Mm-hmm. The thing to do, if there's any question, and of course there are references, internet references, where you can look up pictures, and there are lots of other things coming online every day. That's one possibility. That's especially important, or could be especially important, for people who take many different medications, multiple medications. And so, if you can sync together a name and the appearance of a tablet or capsule or a bottle, then that gives you even greater assurance. Again, if you have any question or any thought that what you've received is not the correct medication, in that case, the person to go back to is the pharmacist who dispensed it in the beginning. And this can be an issue, by the way, with generic pharmaceuticals, which have the advantage of cost savings, but because you don't always get the same brand of generic drug, there can be a difference in appearance, which is confusing and disorienting to some folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, let us talk with some people who are calling in here. We'll start with a caller in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question on your dietary supplement, DHEA.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be covered in your book, and are there tests? I understand it's a hormone that, for men at least, diminishes your own body production of it as you age. I'm 77, and I was wondering if the appropriate thing to do is to get a test to see what my DHEA level is before I take any supplements. And then if your book covers it, that might help me understand a little bit more about what I should be asking to the physician.
Well, in the first place, we don't cover it because we are limited. We have purposely limited ourselves only to approved prescription products. And that, in part, has to do with space limitations and, there's only so many pages they'll give us.
Yes.
So basically we don't cover it. But as far as DHEA goes, you're correct in saying that there is a reduced amount of it produced by your body. The question that I have, and I don't know that much about it, so I really don't want to sound too authoritative here, but the question that I have is that DHEA supplements that you can buy in a health food store, for example, I'm not sure how they're absorbed and what happens to them because, before they're absorbed in the stomach or through the GI tract, they're processed by acids and enzymes. So in the most cases, these products are broken down to their basic elements or their basic nutrients. And so DHEA is likely not absorbed as DHEA, and then the question is whether or not it would enhance it would work in the same way, let's say, as a naturally produced hormone. So,
right. Well, that's why I was thinking that if there is a test, for example, for DHEA level,
mm-hmm.
a blood test, I assume, if I had one done now and then started taking it, and then maybe a few months later, get another test.
Right.
Would that be a way of understanding, first of all, realize or the awareness that my current level is too low or
right.
lower than it should be?
Right.
And then secondly, whether or not the pill really is working.
Well,
is that a strategy that's relevant?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly a strategy to see what, how it's whether or not the level goes up. I mean, certainly also it becomes a question, I think, then of how it affects you and how you feel. I can't make any recommendations on that. I think personally it's not something I would do, but that's me.
Okay. Good. That, and that's good advice because you know a lot about pills. Anyway, well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let me introduce again our guest, Dr. Harold Silverman. He's been a hospital pharmacist, an industry consultant, author, and educator for more than 35 years. He's taught pharmacology and clinical pharmacy at several universities, and he is the editor-in-chief of The Pill Book. It is a reference guide to some of the most prescribed prescription medications in the United States. It's available to the paperback. It's published by Bantam, and would be a good thing to have in your house as part of your home medical reference library, because it has information on some of the, certainly not all, but some of the most frequently prescribed prescription medicines. It talks about what they are, what they're for, the usual dosage, the possibility of side effects, and what to do if there's an overdose, and so forth. So it's a good piece of information to have sitting on your bookshelf at home. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore.
Actually, David, I wanted to point out that in terms of the medications that people take or use themselves, we cover well over probably 90% of everything that's prescribed or the most commonly prescribed, because when you look at breakdowns of how prescription drug surveys, you find that the top 200 drugs accounts for about 75% of all prescribing, and we have 1,800 different products covered in the book. So, we're getting up there in terms of completeness. So.
Okay. So I suppose if there's something that's not here, people will just have to go down to the library and look at the physician's desk reference. Then,
well,
I guess they could do that.
Even that, you see, they face the same problem that we do. Although the pill book is revised every 2 years, and they do the PDR every year. Yeah. The problem that people might have is that, there's a cutoff date. So, for example, we just finished the book in January, the manuscript in January this past year, and the new edition was just released the very end of April. Now, since in between that time, there's been a couple of new products introduced, and there'll be a number of new products introduced over the next couple of years that we'll pick up. But because of the nature of the beast, the fact that it's a print, it's a book rather than an electronic thing you can update, we're going to be behind. So that's the one area that we can't improve on. The only place that people can find information about new drugs or drugs that are so new that we couldn't pick them up would be a reference source like some internet search or something. But beyond that, we in almost 1,300 pages provide information, as I said, on 1,800 or so different products.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other callers here, and we'll go next to Wellington. This is line number four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I've had kind of an interesting experience in the last couple of months. I've dealt with a major pharmacy chain in our area, and I've tried to get two prescriptions filled, and one they told me they're no longer manufacturing it, which is Respair, which worked quite well for me because when I catch a sore throat or a cold, I seem to have chest congestion.
Right.
And so they say it's no longer being made. And it's about the most effective thing that I've ever taken. So they've sent me off to Mucinex D, which is, one of those behind-the-counter, non-prescription things, which is not nearly as effective. And number one, do you have any suggestions for an alternative? And then the other thing was, I usually keep on hand codeine cough syrup that we've used for quite a number of years, and all of a sudden they've told me they've had it on back order for 2 months. What is the deal here with this sort of thing?
Well, as far as Respair goes, I have to check. I don't know exactly all the ingredients, but I know that there have been some changes in that. Mucinex D is it's basically an over-the-counter drug that you have to buy from behind the counter because it contains pseudoephedrine. And it's probably about as effective as anything else that, you know, you're going to find. It's interesting. I'm surprised. I wonder if that Respire, because my references that I have say that Respire is still available. So I'm curious to see, and I'm going to check this right now while I'm here, if it's on a recently discontinued list, because I would have no reason to think that they, that they would tell you that they can't get it for any reason. As far as codeine cough syrups not being available, there's a problem with all controlled substances, even codeine cough syrups, which I know a lot of people, including even in our family, we have on hand for use during the winter months. They've really been pushing, and it may be the brand, or if it's just a generic codeine syrup, I'm surprised that it's not available.
Well, I took my prescription back and said, well, I'm going to try another pharmacy, but I just thought that was kind of weird because it...
I'm surprised. I can't tell you. And actually, Respire, now that I look at it, it's interesting. I mean, I would think that Mucinex D would work at least as well as Respire.
Now, the Mucinex D, I had the 12-hour.
Right.
Now, so a pharmacist told me that there's also a 24-hour one.
Yeah.
So is that more effective than the 12-hour one?
No, it's the same product. It's just a matter of the time release, the period over which the medication is released,
okay.
And the amount that's in there.
Uh-huh.
It should not be any different in terms of its effectiveness. The only reason why I can see that the Respire capsules might have been discontinued would have been a choice made by the manufacturer that they no longer wanted to make the pseudoephedrine-based product, the Sudafed product, because that's now controlled. And as you know, with Mucinex D, you have to buy it behind the counter because of the relationship, the fact that pseudoephedrine can be manipulated and manufactured by individuals
right.
into...
I live in a rural area, so I understand all about meth
yeah,
production.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the side issues that's very aggravating is now I am paying twice as much
right.
for 10 less pills
right.
As I was for the other. Not only is it not count now that it's quote-unquote OTC, it doesn't count toward my insurance deductible, which is huge.
I know.
It's non-tax deductible for
yep.
me. And, those are just little, not only am I getting a less effective product, but I got all these little site annoyances, too. So.
Well, that's one of the real questions about this whole notion of switching prescription drugs to OTC status. And as you pointed out, in fact, one of the huge proponents of that switch has been the insurance industry because of exactly what you said. They don't have to pay for them.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right,
great.
Thank you for the call. Let's continue. And our next caller is in Urbana and on line number 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hey. I feel like I'm talking to a walking encyclopedia here, but my question is about medications that breast cancer survivors would take.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with, like, Femara and tamoxifen?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, 10 years ago, they gave me the 5-year prescription for tamoxifen, and I had to quit it because it just made me crazy,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't like the side effects, so I got 3 years in on it, and then I just said, eh. And ever since then, I've just been wandering around the world. So then we hear the good news about Femara, and I'm wondering does that have, are you aware of side effects, or is it true what we hear about, that it's supposed to make life even longer because it might deflect any cancer eruptions?
Yeah, Femara, that's some of the more recent information. It's certainly something that has some good information behind it. It's in a different class of drugs than tamoxifen. As far as the, you know, the adverse effects, I mean, they're some of the usual ones that you'll find. I mean, most commonly weakness, nausea, headache, flushing of the face and skin, and then, you know, back pains and pain, and then from there you go on to less common ones. As side effects go, it's really not bad. It works well enough that it's certainly worth a try, and I think it's something that, you know, you should be considering. But clearly this is a decision that you have to make with a doctor who's treating you, because he or she will have to incorporate their understanding and their ability to discuss the specific application of Femara in this situation.
Yeah. Is there an indication there as to how long a course of this medication would be for an effective?
I believe it's, and that I don't have at hand. But I believe it's a long-term process. I mean, it's not something that you're going to take for a few months, or, I mean, we're talking years here, so.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, thank you for the info.
All sure. Right,
thank you for the call. We are at our midpoint, or just a tiny bit beyond, and just let me take enough time to introduce again our guest, and then we'll continue to take questions. Our guest is Dr. Harold Silverman. He is a doctor of pharmacy. He has taught clinical pharmacy and pharmacology at several universities. He's also been a hospital pharmacist and an industry consultant, author, and educator for more than 35 years, and he is the editor-in-chief of The Pill Book. This is a reference guide to prescription medication. It is available in paperback. It's published by Bantam. Has now been in existence for 13 editions. This is the new and revised 13th edition, and it could be a good thing for you to have in your home on your reference shelf with other kinds of health and medical reference books, because indeed it has most of the most commonly prescribed medications. And if you're interested in information about what these things are and how they're supposed to work and what they're for and the dosages and potential side effects, that has all this information, and it's presented in a way that should be accessible to the average person. You don't have to be a doctor or a pharmacist to get the information. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. And let's go again to another caller here. The next person is in Crete, Illinois. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We were wondering about generic drugs.
Yes.
Who makes them? And does the pharmacist at our local drugstore know if they've changed the pharmaceutical company? Is it made in China? Is it made in Chile?
Right.
The pharmaceutical company and location are important things, and we need to keep up on that situation. I just wondered if you had any comment to make.
Sure. I actually am very familiar with generic drugs. I actually, just as a sidelight, I do the chapter on generic drugs.
Oh, I can second it.
I'm sorry? Yes. Oh, okay. I do the chapter on generic drugs in the Merck Home manual. So, in any case, generic drugs are a great way for people to save money. The potential problem with them is that there are a few situations, not many, but there are a few situations where you have to be careful with generics, especially with drugs that are where the dose is close to the safe and effective dose is close to a dose that could be toxic, and the one that comes to mind there is digoxin. Another group where you have to be a little careful is with thyroid replacement drugs. As far as, and there some could be some problems with long-acting drugs, there have been many reports of that sort of thing happening. As far as how they're made and where they're made, when a pharmaceutical product is approved in the U.S., the new chemical entity, goes through an extensive approval procedure that includes establishing both how safe the drug is, that it's safe enough for use, and whether or not the drug is effective. Does it work? It also goes through a set of criteria that have to be met for its manufacturing that shows that the specific pill can be releases the medicine in the body in such a manner that it will actually be utilized and produce the desired effect. When generics are manufactured, because the active ingredient has already been vetted by FDA in that way, they don't have to go through those other procedures. They do, however, have to conduct the same studies that the brand name companies do in terms of being sure that their product is released and delivers its content into the bloodstream so that the active ingredient can produce its beneficial effects. And there are a great many generic companies in this country. The products, by and large, but not entirely, are actually produced in the United States. But the question is where the raw materials come from. And many of those, if not, I would say actually most of those, come from outside of the U.S. They're made by chemical companies outside. But those active ingredients are used by both the brand name companies and the generic companies. So it becomes then the responsibility of both FDA and the manufacturer itself to, well, in the case of FDA, to inspect those plants, which they, I guess, try to do every 2 years now, to make sure that everything is up to par. And as far as the manufacturer goes, any drug manufacturer, whether it's brand name or generic, has to go through processes that verify that what they're putting into their products are exactly what they think they're putting into their products and not something different. Of course, this has been in the news lately with heparin, a blood thinner that's given by injection, which was contaminated and which was produced in China for a U.S. company. The problem, or part of the problem, is that in a case like that, it's not the information on where the product was manufactured was just not available to pharmacists because the product wasn't labeled that way. So part of the response to this situation has been for some proposals to have been put forth that, for example, all products should have on their label not only where the company is, but where it was actually manufactured, or where the raw materials came from, and so forth and so on, so that people beyond the manufacturer could know that. But as far as the pharmacist goes, then what happens sometimes is that you find that the particular generic product, the popular generic product, may be bought from one manufacturer because it's the best, you know, it meets the price, it meets the requirements medically, but is the least expensive. So they buy that product and that's what they use. Now, if the following year or the following month or 6 months later, another product they bid this out on a contract, let's say it's a chain drugstore, and they bid it out for use all over the country or in a region, let's say in the upper Midwest, for example, they might change products. And so the tablet or capsule might have a different shape or a different imprint on it. And the only disadvantage to that is that it becomes can become confusing for individual patients. And in that case, you really need to go back and question the pharmacist and say, is this the right medication? Because it's not what I got last time. It's not what I'm used to taking. So,
I hope that...
Where's it coming from?
Go ahead, caller. You want to follow up on that?
Can we know each month when we go for a generic where it's coming from and who's making it?
I believe that most states require, I know the states that I'm familiar with, require that the manufacturer of the product of the generic has to be listed on the prescription label. Now, I'm not familiar with Illinois regulations, but I'm pretty, I mean, I know that they're certainly current, and I would imagine that that information is available, should be written, actually typed right onto the label, at least in some abbreviated form. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very
All right, thanks.
Much.
Sure.
But then again, going back to the story that you talked about that people have been hearing about, that doesn't necessarily mean, though, if the medication was indeed manufactured in the United States,
mm-hmm.
but was made from some raw materials that came from outside of the United States,
right.
So at this point, that the medication wouldn't have to say that.
Right. It wouldn't, the source of the origin of the active ingredient yeah. wouldn't be on there, but the company who was the maker or, in some cases, the distributor of the product would be on there. However, in that chain of through which the product passes, you know, there are people, let's say, as in the case of this heparin, Baxter Laboratories, which is actually an Illinois company, was responsible for knowing what it was in there. So, you know, there were people who fell down on both sides of the ocean because the facility hadn't been inspected by FDA, I think, in a while, and so that wasn't certain. And then evidently the quality assurance people at Baxter didn't catch this either. So it was, people messed up all around, and that's not in an ideal situation, of course, and in the vast majority of situations, they do find out what's happening, but in this case, it just happened to go through, sadly. So,
let's talk next with a Champagne caller, line 3. Yes. Hello.
Good morning. I have 3 interrelated questions mm-hmm. about selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Right.
And serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRI and SRI.
Mm-hmm.
First question, what is the difference between the two?
Well, the selective ones are a little. They're the that's the more common term for drugs like Prozac and Zoloft and what have you.
That's the SSRI.
That's the SSRI. Serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and the reason that they're selective is that they actually are function on one of the subtypes of serotonin. Serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SRIs, are not quite as specific, and so they actually affect more of the subtypes. That's the only difference between them.
I take anafrinil and Celexa, and which are which for those two drugs?
Well, Celexa is an SSRI.
SSRI.
Yeah.
Okay. And anafrinil.
That one I have to check on, which will take me just a moment.
Sure.
Okay, anafrinil is actually, let me make sure I'm... Yeah, anafrinil is a tricyclic antidepressant. So anafrinil is really totally different.
It's not. It's neither an SRI nor an SSRI?
Right.
Really?
Yeah, it's a tricyclic. It's actually an older product.
Right.
Which actually, interestingly, people thought that the SSRIs would be a lot more effective than the tricyclics, which were used successfully for many years. The major difference between them is that tricyclics can be more dangerous and can have more side effects, and so the other ones are considered a lot safer and are, you know, very widely prescribed. But the fact that you're using both, obviously, I would assume that you're seeing a doctor who's really tuned into this stuff.
Yeah, I'm obsessive compulsive, and Naprinil is the old drug.
Right.
And I've gone down to 75 milligrams from 200 for years now.
Right.
And that's about the effective level. And so he suggested some Celexa to go along with that, now that I have such a
right.
low doses of
Right. Yeah, and yes, in the old days, the only thing it would do would be to, you know, try to go back and bump up that level of anafrenil. But what... Actually, it sounds that what he's doing is holding that at the lowest effective
right.
dose to minimize side effects and
right.
then supplement it with another product that's safer but can also help.
Right. My other question is, are there any new drugs for obsessive-compulsive behavior?
Not that I'm familiar with at this moment. No.
Okay. My last question is also about the generic drugs, both Celexa and
Anafrenil
are both now generic.
Yes.
And so how can I find out, you know, where the products come from? At one point, I went to one pharmacy.
Right.
And they gave me Celexa, but it didn't look like the original manufacturer.
Right, right.
And so I went back to my old pharmacy, and it looked like the same old pills I had gotten under prescription.
Right.
So it's pretty common for the same producer to keep producing it, even though it's now a generic.
Yes, they do. They do keep producing it. Typically, what happens with once a product goes generic, prescriptions for the brand name version go down by 75% or 80%.
Right.
They lose the vast majority of their market. But there are many reasons why individuals choose to stay with a brand name. Usually, just personal choice, and there's a whole there's a variety of other reasons. And so there is a smaller market for it. You know, cost-wise, it's going to cost you more, as you, I'm sure, know well, for the brand name when the generic is available.
Right.
But that becomes a personal choice, and, you know, it's something that you have the option to do. So.
Well, I was very reluctant for years to do a generic because
mm-hmm.
I was concerned that it would not be as effective.
Right.
Who
right.
was manufacturing it, and... Oh, I really did not want to disturb my psyche any more than
right.
I used to.
Right, and that's totally understandable, sure.
My last question is, how can I find out where my drugs are being manufactured? Can I go to the pharmacist for this?
Well, you can go to the pharmacist and ask. I think what they'll the only information that they'll be able to give you would be the name of the manufacturer and their location, you know, their location of their offices. From that point on, right now, I'm not sure, you know, other than going to the internet and looking up the company and finding out the location of their plants, for example, would you specifically be able to find the...
That is online.
Some of it is, yeah, and some of it, right. I mean, it's variable, but yes, some of it is usually on that information can be found. excuse me. And one of the other things I wanted to point out, by the way, talking about generics in general, is that there are many, many situations where generic companies don't have, you know, have extra capacity. In other words, they have the ability to do additional manufacturing beyond that which fulfills their own needs. And so what happens is they then become contract manufacturers for brand name products. And so it's conceivable in many cases that the production line that was manufacturing, you know, generic drug X, a generic version of drug X today, next week may be manufacturing the brand name version of that same product, but, you know, with all the logos and all the, you know, everything. So it's kind of an irony in terms of the way the system is set up, but it does happen.
Yeah, I want to thank the caller. I have one more caller here. I want to make sure I try to get
it. Oh, okay.
And let's go to line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. The information that comes with statin drugs warns against eating or too much grapefruit or grapefruit juice.
Yes.
At the same time. And someone told me that the same holds true for pomegranate juice. Do you know if that's true, and do you know what the reason is?
Well, the reason is because there are enzymes in the grapefruit juice that actually stimulate liver enzymes to break the drug down more quickly. And so that actually, and that's covered in the food interaction section of the pill book. Pomegranate juice, let me check. I actually have a source here that I can check on that. I don't think pomegranate juice, but it will take me 2 seconds here. To find that. The interaction, as far as I know right now, is really only well documented with grapefruit juice, and it is very well documented. I take statins, and I love grapefruit juice. So it was one of the things that I was sad to have been able to have to give up. But it's a serious issue, and by the way, it doesn't only affect it affects other drugs besides that as well, besides the statins. But the statins are one of the more important and well-established interactions.
I'm sorry.
So that more of it gets into the system than should. Is that right?
No, it's actually after it gets into the system. In other words, what happens is the grapefruit juice actually stimulates the liver to break down the enzyme system in the liver. It makes it more active. And so by making the enzyme system in the liver where the statin is broken down more active, it sort of chews it up more quickly. It's like getting lower mileage. You know, if you have a car that burns gas more quickly, you're getting lower mileage. So you're not getting the effectiveness
that
you
wanted. Oh, so you get less effect from it.
So you get less effect, and because it's the engine is revved up, so to speak, in the liver, you're getting this excess metabolism, and so it's chewing it up more quickly.
Mm-hmm. So is it just grapefruit juice or any other citrus fruit?
It's grapefruit juice, and I haven't seen any other...
Okay, so a little bit of pomegranate you wouldn't think is...
Yeah, I would think it's okay.
That's kind of what I've been doing, just drinking a little bit, hoping that... Because I haven't myself seen this warning anywhere, but somebody thought they had seen it in a newsletter somewhere, so I thought I'd check.
I haven't seen it with other products specifically, but that's not to say it doesn't occur, but I'm not aware of it, and I haven't seen it in any of the databases that I've worked with. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
And just to finish up here, because we're here at the end, Ken, should we assume that these kinds of questions, things like potential side effects, how to take the medicine, take it with food, don't take it with food, of something like avoid drinking grapefruit juice or anything like that, that all of this information should be provided to the patient probably by the dispenser, by the pharmacy?
Right. Well, now, yes, these days pharmacies dispense usually, especially the chain stores, but they dispense a very brief blurb of information with each new prescription. Mm-hmm. And because they keep it on file, it can be printed out at any time. So that basic information is provided.
Right. Well, we're at the point we're going to have to stop. If you're interested in information about common prescription drugs, this is one reference you might even want to have in your home on your bookshelf, the book we've been talking about. Its title is The Pill Book, and it is published in paperback by Bantam. And our guest is the editor-in-chief, Dr. Harold Silverman. And Dr. Silverman, I want to thank you very much. And I guess maybe just before we go real quick, we should get in the plug for the pharmacist as a good source of information.
Absolutely.
Questions. Ask the pharmacist. I'm sure that they'll be happy to try to help you out.
Absolutely. That's what they want to do. They want to be there to help their patients.
All right. Well, again, thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate it.